Live from high atop the McCombs Business School at the University of Texas, this is Gary Hoover in an experimental podcast. We'll see how this one goes. Please email me and let me know if it sounds okay and what you think of it. It's a new idea, at least for me. Today I want to talk about the history of federated department stores. As you know, I'm a business history buff, and I especially love retailing. And I believe retailing has all kinds of great lessons to teach us. There have been a lot of interesting business models, as they would say these days. And one of the most fascinating companies that we can learn from was this company called Federated Department Stores. Let me tell you a little about the history of the department store in America. Depending on your age, you may remember a time when every downtown in America had great big department stores. You can also find them in Japan and Western Europe and a few other places. But it was an idea. Most people give credit to the Bon Marché in Paris, which was founded in 1852. You had independent merchants selling different things, usually what they called dry goods and linens and things like that, sometimes ladies' clothing, sometimes men's clothing. And over time, they would expand. They'd say, oh, we ought to add this, we ought to add that. And then they grew in departments. A real pioneer in the United States was a man named Alexander Stewart, S-T-E-W-A-R-T, who in 1823 opened the biggest store in America in Lower Manhattan in New York City. And he built a large store and is really the leader of the department store movement in the United States. He lived till 1876. Following him, in 1851, the Lazarus family in Columbus, Ohio started what became a great store. In the 1858, R.H. Macy, who had failed three times. A lot of these people had a lot of failures where they got it right. But finally, in 1858, he got it figured out and built a great Macy's store. Not the one we know today, a much smaller store lower in Manhattan. Let's see, who else? 1860s, John Wanamaker in Philadelphia, Marshall Field in Chicago. By the 1870s, William Filene in Boston, F-I-L-E-N-E. 1888, one of the later ones, J.L. Hudson in Detroit. Detroit was a city that was bloomed a little later than these other cities, and so it got its big department store a little later. And I'm skipping lots of others, some of which predate these. Lord & Taylor in New York's from the 1820s, Shillitoe's in Cincinnati, the 1830s. So all through that era, but the real idea of the department store really came to blossom in the 1870s, 80s, and 90s, as these folks began to build big palaces of consumption, of retailing everything imaginable under one roof. And they usually sold the stuff cheaper. They were often the discounters of their day because they had lower overhead, because they spread that overhead over all those departments, and they bought in big quantities from their suppliers, their vendors, and that also helped them lower the cost. And these were exciting, important places. When they would open a big store in a big U.S. city, would draw hundreds of thousands of people to their grand openings. And it's a big deal. And it's where the buses would all stop, or the old streetcar days, or have the subway nearby if you could. Anyway, as that industry evolved, and all those companies were independent, local family-owned businesses. These weren't giant corporations. It was like Mr. Filene in Boston or Mr. Lazarus in Columbus running their own business, building it up to turn it over to their sons. It was back in an era when daughters were not put in charge of things. And so you had all these businesses, and each of them, they knew each other. You know, they would buy from some of the same sources. Some of them controlled their own factories. They would go to Europe and buy the finest of linens and other stuff and bring it over. China from Bohemia, I mean, glassware, cut glass, cut crystal from Bohemia and China, I guess, what, Limoges? I don't know how to say it, from France. And of course, Waterford and Wedgeford, and a lot of those guys have been around a long time. But these people knew each other. But each department store had its own personality. In one, you might find they had the best toy department in America. The next one would have a wonderful book department. Wanamaker's was famous for that. The next one would have a fine dining. In fact, old Marshall Field in Chicago, he didn't think anybody wanted to eat in his stores. He said, no, we we shouldn't serve food. It would spill on the merchandise. Nobody wants to eat there, here to shop. And one of his top executives, a guy named H.G. Selfridge, convinced him to open a restaurant. And it became a whole floor. And way back, I think around 1910, it had something like 3,000 employees just in the restaurant floor of that big Marshall Field store on State Street in Chicago. Selfridge later got frustrated with his boss, went on his own, moved to London, and created what was one of London's great department stores, Selfridge's, which is still there. He's long dead and gone, but he was a great merchant. So all these guys, and they're learning from each other, studying each other. Most all of them went to Europe often, because there were, especially in Paris, great department stores. Later on, that tradition evolved in England, and Germany now has great department stores. Anyhow, so we come along, and again, each one was independently owned and operated, had their own style. Not a one-man show, because they could employ thousands, even tens of thousands of people. But still, it was their own personality and style. And by the time we hit 1900, 1910, the kids are taken over. And actually, Filene's in Boston is a great case. He turned it over to his two sons, Abraham Lincoln Filene and Edward A. Filene, who went by Edward and Lincoln Filene. And they took it over from their dad in the 1890s. And he died, I think, 1901. And then they were fully in charge. And they built a great store. They were incredible innovators. Edward A. Filene in particular dreamed up a lot of stuff. A cycle billing is just a technique of retailing. It used to be all the statements, the credit statements to their customers were mailed out on the 30th of the month. And they said, well, that doesn't really quite work for us. Let's even it out and let's have, you know, a quarter of the people build the first week and a quarter the second week and all that. And that was a big innovation. They took extra good care of their employees. They had gave them extra vacation. They were the first retailer in the Boston area to go to a 40-hour work week. If an employee had a grievance or thought they'd been wronged, it went to a board, a council of like three people who were elected by the employees. And they, 55% of the time, voted in favor of the employee, about 42% in favor of the management. And the other 3%, it was some sort of compromise. But very democratic in its own way. Filene was really the creator of the first credit union in America. And made it into a national movement. Filene, the two brothers, one was a Republican, one was a Democrat. Lincoln, the younger brother, he created something called the Retail Research Association in, I think it was 1916. And that was where he got together with a bunch of these other people around the country, these people he knew, like Lazarus in Columbus, Ohio and stuff, and they would share all their internal data. And, of course, that went very much against the tone of retailing. It still does in a lot of ways, where you got people who aren't owned by the same company, don't have the same boss. They aren't competitors because they're in different cities. But they would open up their kimono, as we would say today, and show, here's what our expense rates are. Here's what share of percentage of sales we spend on advertising. Here's our inventory turnover rate. Here's our gross margin, the difference between what you pay for goods and what you sell for them, a real important statistic in retailing. And how our gross margin, what is it in toys? What is it in lingerie? What is it in menswear? What is it in shoes? You know, what is it in corsets back when they had that department? Our notions. I always love that one. And it was really a revolutionary idea. And then as it went on, these guys said, well, what if we pool our buying? And when we go to a manufacturer, all of us buy together at the same time. And they created something called Associated Merchandising Corporation, AMC. So they got in the habit of like hanging out with each other and getting to know each other sharing data that was historically considered incredibly confidential. And I have to say, when I meet, I've spent a lot of my life in retailing and I love it. I work for some big department store companies, including Federated Department Stores. And I'm always urging them, share data with your peers. Find ways to share this data because it's incredibly valuable and it'll help you figure out how to run better stores. In any case, so we come along 1929, before the Depression hit. A man named Rothschild, he ran a store called Abraham and Strauss in Brooklyn, one of America's great department stores, out on his yacht in Long Island Sound with Mr. Lazarus, Fred Lazarus Sr., who had inherited the Lazarus department store in Columbus, Ohio. I'm sorry, it's Fred Lazarus Jr. He was an old man a long time ago, so I think of him as senior. But he was Fred Jr., and he was there, and neither of the Filene brothers, but their right-hand guy who really ran the store by that point, a guy named Louis Kirstein, was on the boat. And they said, well, look, what if we merged our companies and we got stock in a new company, we'll call it Federated Department Stores, and so we're all one company, so if the Boston operation has a bad year, well, Brooklyn will make more money, it'll help it out, you know, it'll kind of even out the ups and downs of our business, because we'll have operations in Columbus, Ohio, and Boston, and Brooklyn. And not everybody was crazy about the idea. In fact, the older Filene brother really fought it, and they kind of drove him out of the company, his younger brother and the rest of the management, in order to do this Federated Department Stores deal. So by end of 29, I guess November 1929, they had formed Federated Department Stores. And actually, the Filenes got about half of the company in the stock, the Filenes people from Boston, because it was a bigger company in sales and in profits. And then the A&S, Abraham Strauss people from Brooklyn, and the Lazarus people from Columbus split the rest. A year later, a guy named Bloomingdale had a store in Manhattan. He joined them too. So by 1930, they'd added Bloomingdale's. And also the Lazarus people, they had bought, a really, weak little department store in Cincinnati called Shillitoe's. It was, I think, fourth biggest in the market. And they bought it in the late 20s, and they turned it around, made it number one in Cincinnati. Anyway, so they put this thing together, but it was these independent companies. They were still, the deal was, they were going to be run by the independent people that, you know, the Filenes and their executives are still going to run Filenes. Rothschild and his buddies were still going to run Abraham and Strauss, A&S in Brooklyn, and the Lazarus family still run the Columbus and Cincinnati operations, and they weren't going to interfere with each other. And they believed in this so strongly, they didn't even set up a headquarters. There wasn't even an office. And if you go look at the financial statements in those early years after 1929, Federated Department Stores, they published a complete balance sheet and a complete profit and loss statement for each of those companies. And they showed that to the public. You look it up in old financial manuals like Moody's and Standard & Poor's, and it's all just laid out. Here's Bloomingdale's financial statement. Here's, because I was looking at them the other night, 1930 data, and they're just like independent companies. And then you add them up, that's the total, and that's what the public owns stock in. Well, it continued along that pattern. And then after World War II, in the late 40s, Fred Lazarus Jr. says, well, you know, we got so many smart people and we're facing new challenges. We're making all this profit, but what if, you know, the Boston operation makes a huge amount of profit, but Boston's not growing fast enough. They don't want to build any more stores up there, but maybe there's big opportunities out in growth markets like Cincinnati and Columbus or whatever, you know, and we should put the money there. So we ought to have some sort of centralization. Again, there was a big battle, big fight, according to what I've been able to read and find out. Lazarus said, look, if you don't do this, I'm going to pull my company out of our deal. And Lazarus had done better than the other companies in the intervening years since the Federated was founded. And so it was a more important part of the company than just the 20% or whatever when they started out. So anyway, so they said, okay, we'll do it. So they create a headquarters, but a very small one. And interestingly, they didn't put it in Columbus where Lazarus and his folks lived. They put it over in Cincinnati. And while I can't find it in any books, what I'd heard in the industry was that Fred Jr. wanted to be away from all his relatives in Columbus, Ohio, and he wanted to let them run the Lazarus division. He wanted to run this new thing, this Federated Department Stores. Well, he didn't still really run it. I mean, he had the finance people, they managed the cash, he had some real estate and legal experts, but it was still, I don't know, 10, 15 people for what was a very important American retailer. Well, then, old Fred Jr., he's down after World War II in Houston, visiting his son, who was stationed at Ellington Field in Houston, and he finds out that the biggest store in Houston is a store called Foley Brothers. But Foley Brothers does about a fourth the sales of his Shillitoe store in Cincinnati. And it's a city of about the same size. Says, look, this is crazy. They're leaving money on the table. There's a big opportunity for us here. And so, you know, in sync with this idea of, oh, let's have some muscle. Let's have some sort of centralization, very modest centralization. He says, well, let's build a store in Houston. And so they bought land. They're working on it. Well, before they got it built, came back, the Foley Brothers was for sale. They bought it. I think they bought it for like $3.5 million. They like doubled the business the next year, doubled it again the next year. 1947, built a big new store, put $10 million into it, more than they paid for the whole company, downtown Houston. And this was a revolutionary store. The interior was designed by Raymond Loewy, who I talk about on my website, probably the greatest industrial designer in American history, one of the founders of the profession. And so, and what was different about this 1947 downtown Houston Foley store? It's the first new department store built in U.S. downtown since I think 1929, like 20 years, and all those old stores had windows, and you know, they look cool from outside, and sunlight came into the store. But what they realized is, well, let's put the merchandise in the center of each floor, and let's have stock rooms around the edge. That way, instead of a stock room being off in another building or down in the basement like in the old days, that way, if you ran out of a certain size of shoe or dress or whatever it was, it was right there beside you. And then also in that Houston heat, it was better not to have any windows and saved them on utilities costs. And so they inverted the store. And if you look at it from the outside, the downtown Foley store is like no windows. You know, it's looks real different. And it was a revolution. But they said, so we streamlined it, we lowered the cost, we made it more efficient, but we still made it very cool to be in, because we hired the best designer in the world, Raymond Loewy, to design the interiors. Very, I don't know if Art Deco is the right term, it's a little late for Art Deco, but certainly very streamlined, kind of modern, I think the architects might call it. Very cool store. Hardly anybody knows this store. It's hard to find out about it, but it shows up in some books about Loewy and stuff. Anyway, the next thing, Lazarus, is like, well, you know, the South and the West are growing faster than the Midwest and the East. We're doing all our business in the Midwest and the East, you know, except for Foley's. Let's start looking around. And I don't even know if the term Sunbelt had been coined yet. I need to look that up. But America, I can assure you, 1948, 1950, 1952 was not talking Sunbelt. Lazarus understood demographics. He understood trends. He bought Sanger's in Dallas. He bought A. Harris in Dallas, merged them to become a company called Sanger Harris. He bought Burdine's in Miami. He bought in an unfriendly takeover, very unusual for the era and really unusual for Federated Department Stores. He took down Bullock's, he acquired Bullock's and I. Magnin out on the West Coast, a big player out there. Took him till I think it was 1976 before he finally got Rich's, which he had lusted after for years, one of America's greatest department stores based in Atlanta, run by the Rich family. And finally, I forget if Mr. Rich died or whatever, but it came on the market and they bought it. Now again, all these people had known each other because they'd been exchanging data in that what was called AMC, Associated Merchandising Corporation. And I actually have some of their old data books going back to the 50s in my library because I love studying those numbers. And anyhow, so the thing is that he really saw the Sun Belt coming. But the key thing was that each store still maintained its personality. It maintained its local relevance. It was run by people in that division. That's what they were called. And it was run by merchants, by people. They weren't, the people that ran these divisions were not people who'd worked their way up through finance or even marketing in the current sense of the word. And a department store like that, they called it sales promotion. These people all came from merchandising. In other words, they had been buyers. They picked what are we going to carry and what are we going to price it at and how many are we going to have. Now, they controlled about everything else. Certainly, they controlled the advertising and the sales promotion. They had a big role in the where do you put stores and how do you design them, because this is the same era they were also building branch stores. And Federated Department Stores, by the time I came onto the scene, I got out of college in 1973. I worked at Citibank in New York picking retail stocks. My boss, the old-timer, a great guy I learned a lot from, he covered the big investments, Sears, Penny, Kmart. My biggest investment I was responsible for was Federated Department Stores and got to know the company really well. And then 2 years later, I ended up going to work for them because I realized it was the best place to learn things about how to be a retailer, which was my dream and my goal. And at that point, let's see, Bloomingdale's was on the cover of Time magazine right about then. And Bloomingdale's was the most happening store in America, the greatest fashion store. But when I joined the Sanger Harris, the Dallas division of Federated, which was a great store. And Mr. Lazarus, Fred Jr. had died and his son Ralph had taken over. So Mr. Ralph. To keep them apart, they call him Mr. Fred, Mr. Ralph, and all that, kind of a southern thing almost. And so Mr. Ralph, he was allowed in each division once a year. He came to Sanger Harris once a year, one day a year, fully announced, big, like on parade and everything. I still remember to this day. So I'm standing there. I was the book buyer, about as low on the totem pole as you can be. Next to me was my divisional merchandise manager. He oversaw books and stationery and luggage and a bunch of what they call small wares. It wasn't clothing where most of the money was made. He had been in clothing, but they moved him around. You try to get a lot of experience. And so me, my divisional merchandise manager, next to him was the general merchandise manager who oversaw all the home store, all the home furnishings and furniture and small wares. And then next to him was the chairman of the Dallas division, a guy named Don Stone. And he was the man with all the power, incredibly well paid back in those days. And the word was, hey, as long as you make a projection and say, here's what we're going to do, every sales goal, as long as you make those numbers, it was your kingdom. They didn't interfere. And you had a secure job. You stopped failing to achieve your goals, you were gone. But there was not a huge amount of turnover compared to some industries. But in any case, And I had an in-depth training program where they found the very best people very young and tracked them and developed them. Anyway, this was the day that Mr. Ralph was in town. So me, divisional merchandise manager, general merchandise manager, Don Stone, the chairman, and then Mr. Ralph. And he's going through department by department, walking through the store. And we're lined up. And Mr. Ralph is saying something, I'm sure something very intelligent and very important. And he says, what about this? And Don Stone, the chairman of the Dallas division, in the middle of his boss's sentence says, excuse me. And he steps away and he sees an old lady that's there in my book department looking for some book. And he says, ma'am, can I help you find something? I'm shaking in my boots. I'm saying, oh, man, right now I'm witnessing the end of this guy Stone's career. He's over with. Well, he wasn't over with. Ralph Lazarus knew exactly what he was doing. He was teaching me and everybody else within sight a lesson that I don't give a blank who is standing there, how important they are, how nice the car, how rich they are. They do not matter compared to that old lady looking for a book. And I will remember that till the day I die. I will also remember that Don Stone was then promoted to be vice chairman of the parent company, Federated Department Stores, and had a huge role and improved the stores. But then when they went and borrowed a huge amount of money, over-leveraged the company, led to their bankruptcy, he quit. He quit before they did that. He wanted nothing to do with all that. And actually walked away from a lot of money, because for a minute there they made a lot of money, the executives did. But he had nothing to do with it. And just a lesson I'll remember all my life. But that model, that idea that Foley's is Foley's in Houston, Burdine's is Burdine's in Miami. Burdine's at one point had the highest volume branch department store in America, just a money machine. A good thing for the customers, wonderful merchandise, big volume store, but a really wonderful thing for Federated Department Stores. It was in a mall called Dadeland Mall, the south end of Miami, down there around Coral Gables and Coconut Grove and all that. And Federated was a great company. And actually, when they went bankrupt, it wasn't because their businesses were losing money. It's because they'd borrowed too much. And so they came out of it pretty quickly. Actually, the word was that Lazarus, at that point, his widow, asked a man named Alan Questrom, Q-U-E-S-T-R-O-M, to come out of retirement or whatever. No, he was probably still working. But come back, Federated, and save the company just in memory of her dead husband. And he did. And he brought it back. And he later turned around JCPenney Company, a really brilliant merchant. He had run Riches before that, the Atlanta store I mentioned. Anyway, Federated comes back from the grave, still, though, making money, a solid, good business. Macy's went through the same thing, did a management buyout, whatever, borrowed too much money, went broke. So when it came out, they merged. Federated actually bought Macy's. And then later they decided, well, let's rename, make all the stores called Macy's. That's been very controversial. That should be the subject of another discussion, because I've already talked a lot longer than I was planning. And today we know it as Macy's, all those old Federated stores, as well as virtually all their competitors. The old May Department Stores Company, where I spent 5 years of my life, based in St. Louis. The old Associated Dry Goods Company, the owners of Lord & Taylor, a wonderful old company. All these guys ended up merging, virtually all of them, outside of Nordstrom's and Dillard's. Those are a few of the ones still left outside, but have become Macy's, which is now a national organization with over 800 stores. But, and they gave up that model. They are no longer independent efficiently run. No longer do they have whole teams of buyers picking the merchandise in each city, because in my era, there were buyers in Dallas for Sanger's. There were buyers in Atlanta for Rich's. We all talked to each other. We all learned from each other, but we were completely independent. You can make a case that that was a very expensive model to have that many sets of buyers, and it wouldn't work in the modern day. I don't think I buy that. There is a value to knowing your community, to advertising in your local newspaper, to having an auditorium where local events took place, supporting the local libraries and the Red Cross, and really having that connection with your community. But I do understand there are two sides of the argument. I believe the man who runs Macy's today, Terry Lundgren, is a really smart guy. He has a wonderful reputation among people I know who I trust and think are good merchants, so I trust their judgment. So it was a hard decision, and they went that way. I might have gone the other way. But in any case, when you're looking at any business, a supermarket business, there's been no successful national chain. I don't count Whole Foods, where I used to be on the board, as a supermarket. I consider it kind of a specialty operator. But the big guys, the Kroger, the Safeway, none of those people have been truly national. They're really regional organizations. The best ones today, HEB in Texas, Publix in out of Florida, Wegmans out of upstate New York, those are really regional companies. So I can make a case in a big business like general merchandise retailing or food retailing, there's a lot to be said for that regional model. And no one ever did it better than Federated Department Stores. And I may have skipped it, but during their glory days, 50s, 60s, 70s, they were the biggest department store company in America. They were the best run. They were the management training ground. They were the most profitable in any measure you want to look at. And they were actually, I think, usually growing faster than their competitors. So they were really the premier company by quite a margin. Every so often, one of the other guys, that's why I did it to make company, figure out how are we going to catch Federated. There was another company called Dayton Hudson, some of you may know, that later became Target. A whole other story, a wonderful story. They were an excellent company, but much smaller. And there was a real, much smaller one called Mercantile Stores. It was really a class outfit that, like, nobody's heard of. Well, someday I'll come back and talk about all those. But look back at Federated Department Stores. Study them. Do a little research. There hasn't been any good book written on them. But there's stuff. There's some pretty good stuff on the Macy's website. Wikipedia has some pretty good stuff. Usually look it up under Macy's, since that's the name of the company today. But it was a wonderful business model. Satisfied huge numbers of customers. It made a lot of stockholders very wealthy. Created wonderful careers for a lot of people, including very highly paid executive positions. And then, one of the other things, they didn't have any retirement age. You could work till you were 80 or 90 because they said, look, you want to work in our store and be a clerk, and you're the best clerk we got, and you want to work till the day you drop. That's fine with us. You know, they still had retirement programs and all that, but they said it's stupid. You know, you're abdicating your responsibility as a manager to have this arbitrary cutoff that you retire at 65. I don't know if they still do that or not. I should check into that. Anyway, that's more than enough for today. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope this method of communicating with you find useful and helpful and interesting. I'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.